What did happen? Okay. See, we did crash. It was on this crazy island. And we waited for rescue, and there wasn't a rescue. And then there was a smoke monster. And then there were other people on the island. We called them the others. And they started attacking us. And we found some hatches, and there was a button you had to push every 180 minutes, or... Well, I was never really clear on that. But the others didn't have anything to do with the hatches. That was the Darmans. They were all dead. The others killed them. And now they're trying to kill us. And then we teamed up with the others because some worse people were coming on a freighter. Desmond's girlfriend's father sent them to kill us. So we stole their helicopter and we flew it to their freighter, but it blew up. And we couldn't go back to the island because it disappeared. So then we crashed in the ocean and we floated there for a while until a boat came and picked us up. And by then there were six of us. That part was true.
I came on a plane.
What plane?
A Jira Flight 316. And that's how I returned to the island.
So, why him?
What was it that was so wrong with me? What about me?
What about you?
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast for Season 6, Episode 8, Recon. Guys, what do you put in the locked room on your submarine? My name's Dave Gonzalez, one of your three hosts, and I put the Nintendo Switch. That's for me and my time off. I don't want people taking it and bringing it to the bathroom and leaving it there. That's gross.
My name's Fiona Robinson. If we're talking about things that Lost likes to put in mysterious hatches, I'm going to go with Anthony Cooper, or at least someone's bad dad. Someone's bad dad in my locked submarine room.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I'm taking another Lost tradition and bringing it to the sub life. I am keeping all of the snacks locked up in a closet somewhere, just like they were in the original hatch that we were in.
Yeah, and then on some glorious day, you're just going to be like, it's a feast, we're eating all the snacks on the locked sub. And
yeah, maybe.
Like, everyone loves Neil.
Yeah, I'm not saying that I would keep the snacks all for me. I just feel like for everyone's safety,
mm-hmm.
we should keep the snacks locked up.
Or right, you end up with, yeah.
The Giacchino score kicks in, and it's slow-mo, and
mm-hmm.
Claire and Charlie get to have some real peanut butter.
Yeah, peanut it's great. Very heartwarming.
Oh, I remember when Claire and Charlie were having a good old time just being normal shipwrecked on an island.
Just jamming their
Claire
dirty
even
island
remembers?
Fingers into some peanut butter.
Does Claire even remember Charlie at this point?
Oh.
Oh.
She'd make a squirrel version of Charlie. Charlie.
If this is your first time joining us, welcome. This podcast is an ideal companion if you're rewatching the ABC series Lost with us or visiting the island and flashing sideways for the very first time. Each episode comes in sections for your listening pleasure. First, there's a calm section that only discusses the preceding episodes and avoids all spoilers. Then there's a second section called The Storm. It's a storm of spoilers discussing this week's episode in the context of the entire series and over a decade of Lost fandom. If you look at your podcasting device that's playing this audio file right now, you will see in the notes time codes so you could revisit those sections, skip the calm for some reason because you think like you're far enough in the season. Whatever you want to do, man, it's your podcast now. For the final season of Lost, we've shifted to releasing the podcast on Saturday evening in the U.S. after our group live watch in our Storm Slack. How do you join those live watches with us, you ask? Why? You go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers. There you will find ways to subscribe to us for a monthly fee, and depending on what level you choose, you get more and more and more bonus content. And when you subscribe for the very first time, you get instant access to all our previous years of bonus content, which include extra interview bits, bonus podcasts, and various oddities. There's even bonus podcasts that come with a watch-long element, like Joanna Robinson and Feels Like the First Time. How you doing there, Joanna? I know you're on vacation, but catch us up with Feels Like the First Time.
Eh, you know, it's a working vacation. I am doing great. In fact, we're recording this on a Tuesday. Tomorrow night, which will be in the past by the time folks hear this. We are watching the last of our drag-themed films for feels like first time watching Kinky Boots. So that should be fun wrap-up to that. But never fear. If you're interested in getting involved in Feels Like the First Time, which is where I show my friend and should be your friend, Kristen Russo, a movie she has never seen before, which are many and vast. Next month, we are doing a series we are calling Angelina July, where we're watching Angelina Jolie movies. We haven't picked which three movies yet, so if you have thoughts and opinions on which three movies I should show Kristen, email me or at me on Twitter. I'll see it.
Has she seen any Jolies that she's already thrown out there?
I'm sure. I think she's really into Angelina Jolie, so it's going to be a harder time. But there's still plenty that she hasn't seen. Like, I definitely got to show her Mr. and Mrs. Smith for the first time in an earlier month watch that we did. So we'll figure out something. Gone in 60 Seconds, Salt. I don't know. There's some stuff.
Wanted.
The Changeling. Wanted.
Ooh, The Changeling.
My son.
Summer film. Of course, that's not the only way you can spend some time with us. You can always hang out with us in our Patreon Slack. You can tweet at us at Storm Podcast. That's a good way to find us. You can email us, host@stormpodcast.com. We got a bunch of good Stormy emails this week, and I think we're going to continue to get some good stuff right as we come to the end here of the show. And you can find our schedule over at stormpodcast.com. And you can also leave us a review. We didn't get any new reviews this week, so that means I have to read the mean ones from last week that I skipped.
Oh, that's what that
means. Yeah. So here we go.
These are the island's rules. What can we say?
Yeah. Someone whose name appears to be Skinneb, I think, from Canada wrote, 2 stars. Ugh, I wish she wouldn't interrupt. I'm at season 2, episode 3, and I don't know if I can keep listening. Joanna continually interrupts the guys. It's seriously bad in this episode, especially. I'll continue for one more episode, but if it keeps up, I'm going to have to pass. I'm guessing this person will never hear their review read on this podcast. Yeah. But who knows? And then we've got this one from Gabe, I've been stormed H, who wrote, 5 stars. Great at not spoiling Lost. Terrible at not spoiling Game of Thrones. Hey guys, what year is it? 2021? Okay.
Well, I feel like that tagline is like the 100% operating accurate thing of our entire podcast.
We used to be a Game of Thrones podcast about spoiling Game of Thrones. All right, look, the show is great. And you should listen to it right now. Joanna's right about everything, Dave's wrong about everything, and Neil is also there. Wow, okay. off to a great start. Okay.
No, let's give this guy some space. He seems like he's on some sort of wavelength.
But here's my beef. I decided to start reading Game of Thrones after refusing to drink the Kool-Aid for the last decade. After falling in love with the storm, I thought, well, if my favorite podcast hosts who love Lost also love Game of Thrones, it can't be that bad, can it? Anyway, here I am, happily reading Game of Thrones and listening to my Lost Rewatch podcast when Joanna comes stomping through with Shannon's actually dead. Like, she's not going to die and come back to life. They're not going to pull a Jon Snow on us. For real? I barely started Clash of Kings. Then, some episodes later, completely uncalled for, they decided to reminisce about how awful it was when Tyrion killed Shay. Are you serious? Antagonist, check it. Guess what? It's you! Anyway, it's a great podcast with great hosts, even you, Dave, and you should listen to it, even if they're actually trying to ruin Game of Thrones for me. These are the reviews I refused to read last week that, you know, I had no choice. I had to read them this week. So if you don't want me to read other terrible reviews, please do drop us a review.
Also, that second one is hilariously entertaining to me. Yeah. And gave us 5 stars. So if you're going to do that, you're like, go ahead. That's semi-acceptable.
Do you remember when we, in season 5 of Game of Thrones, spoiled the fact that Game of Thrones wouldn't end well?
Mm-hmm. Or when...
That's how good we are at spoiling
entire
Game of
series
Thrones.
Started on HBO, everybody who had read the books was already like, Jon Snow's coming back in the next one? Like, I feel like that's not on us at all.
Enjoyed this. This is a fun review.
Yeah, good job, reviewer. I'm not at all sorry for what we did for you. Your title / subtitle of your review is the mission statement of our podcast.
I enjoyed Keep getting stormed, man. I enjoyed just being here for it.
Yeah, I mean, Neil, yeah, exactly.
Neil, you're way more than just here, by the way.
Thank you.
FYI. Thank you. Okay. Then we got an email from Lucy, which I think is a fun prompt. The title of the email is Lost Cast Other Roles. Lucy says, hello and welcome to the email. I just finished watching For All Mankind on Apple TV Plus. I was really digging the Molly Cobb character, and I had one of those I know her from something moments and had to check her out on IMDb. She's Penny from Lost. I was floored. Sonya Walger is as good as Penny, but I love her as Molly Cobb. I was wondering, what is your favorite role the cast members did outside of Lost? Were they better in another role, or was Lost their zenith? Thanks for all the work you do producing this podcast weekly, Lucy. I just wanted to shout this out because I watched a bit of For All Mankind because I did a Joel Kinnaman interview for VF.com. And that's a show that a lot of people are sleeping on. Another Apple show that I will sort of flog, but let this be a mini storm chasing that. Yeah, this is like, I don't know if you guys, have you guys heard about
For All Mankind? I stopped like halfway through the first season and have been thinking about going back to it because I've heard similar things, like especially season two is good.
Exactly. Like season one starts, it's an alternative history. It's from Ron Moore and two guys who worked on Fargo. And it's an alternative history of like, what if the Soviet Union beat the U.S. To the moon landing? And when I was talking to Joel Kinnaman about it, he's like, yeah, the first season is a real like sort of Mad Men, but make it NASA kind of vibe. He's like, season two definitely starts getting into more genre stuff. Like it gets a little less, it gets a little more Battlestar Galactica, a little less Mad Men and NASA. And it just sort of goes from there. And it hops, like it starts in 1969, but it hops decades. And then at the end of season two is like you're in 1995 already. So that's an interesting thing they're doing. And Joel Kinnaman's like, it's going to get even wilder in season three. So I think, yeah, I think it's a good thing. I'm a big Joel Kinnaman fan. And I think he's great on the show. And yeah, Sonya Walger is also there. And yeah, I think it's a show that a lot of people are going to regret sleeping on if they don't hop on board. So, and like with all Apple shows, I think, or a lot of Apple shows, like similarly Mythic Quest and stuff like that. Like, I think this is a good show that was really missing its audience and has started to find it in season two. Apple has like figured out how to promote its shows better in season two, or they just need one good hit like Ted Lasso. So I don't know. Anyway, so that brings us to our prompt. Lost cast in other roles. Any thoughts or feelings about that one, Dave Gonzalez?
Mine are specifically like, oh, hey, I forgot he was in that movie. But I feel like we all could, you know, go the Hobbit route for Dom. So I think outside of that, I'm a very big fan of Terry O'Quinn's Howard Hughes in a little movie called The Rocketeer. Because that's ridiculous if you know anything about Howard Hughes, for him to A, show up in that movie, and Terry O'Quinn plays him as like not crazy at that point in his life when he like definitely was. Really, really interesting choice. And I'm trying to think about, like, you know, you have Evangeline Lilly in The Wash, you have like, didn't Josh Holloway pop up in a Go to Call?
He did, right? Briefly.
Yeah, and but that was more like a, oh, hey, there, it's you. It's like, yeah. Sawyer, I missed you.
He just shows up to get murdered in one scene, and it's very sad because Josh Holloway would have been much better than
You're like,
than,
oh my god,
Jeremy
Josh Holloway
Renner.
In a Mission Impossible. That's what I want. But
and instead, you get a lot of Renner. Actually, I like Renner and Go to Call, but anyway.
Yeah.
And then Matthew Fox, from my understanding, it's not like he dropped off the face of the earth, but he did that one like thriller where he got really gaunt, and then I stopped seeing him pop up in like... movies. Like, isn't he like in World War Z for like two shots or some shit like that? So it's hard sometimes with the most notable characters because I'm trying to think about, you know, what they did directly afterwards, if they did any sort of big cinematic things. Evangeline Lilly obviously stepped in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but is that a better character for her? Not yet. I don't know.
Yeah. I have two for Daniel Day Kim.
That was a good one.
Big DDK fan here.
Mm-hmm.
One, the Netflix, I think I talked about the Netflix movie Stowaway that was released this year with him and Anna Kendrick and Toni Collette on a storm chasing.
Yeah.
Excellent. Also very much enjoyed him popping up in The Legend of Korra. So just on the record. He's got a great voice.
And he uses that great voice in Raya mm-hmm. as well. Yeah.
So just more Daniel Day Kim everywhere is my standing policy.
I first knew Naveen Andrews from his appearance in The English Patient, in which he was very good. But it's not he's sort of like a manic pixie, Dead Nation specialist. So, like, you know, Saeed is definitely more of a complex role for him. He's also in Bride and Prejudice, but that's a movie I have mixed feelings about. But he plays Mr. Bingley in that. Yeah. Terry O'Quinn in Alias, which is like the show that got him Lost, is always a fun watch. Terry O'Quinn is in a lot of good stuff. Henry and Cusick, I have mixed feelings about for a lot of different reasons, but he shows up in Dead Like Me, maybe like the movie that they did. I don't know. Dead Like Me is a show universe that I really loved. If anything deserves a reboot, I think it's Dead Like Me. And then I had one more, which is Emily DeRaven in Brick. I really like Emily DeRaven in Brick, and it's like it's the reason why I'm like I think she can do more than she sometimes does on Lost, because I think she does a bit more in Brick. Once again, she's sort of like a manic pixie, spoiler alert, dead girl. So, you know, I don't know. I do think for most of these actors, Lost is the zenith of their, career. We can list some of the things that they've been
unless you in, really love Matthew Fox in Speed Racer, which a lot of people do.
Oh, Matthew Fox is really good in Speed Racer.
Yeah. Or I guess Party of Five.
You know, Michael Emerson in Person of Interest, like all that sort of stuff. Or people
apparently
really
Evil.
Like him. Yeah,
is pretty
people
good.
Really like him in Evil. But how do you top Ben Linus? I don't know that you quite can. Mm-hmm. So I don't think I've seen any of the regular cast members. Dr. Pierre Chang in our favorite, The Expanse. I don't know. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's true.
We've named some things that people have been in, but none of them I would be like, this is
sadly
definitely
not Elizabeth Mitchell in V.
Well, it also sounds like the original emailer was like, this is good, but it's also Penny. So I think maybe that's just the thing. Lost is a high bar to clear.
Well, the other thing is that I think a lot of the cast members were in Once Upon a Time after this, because it was, you know, run by Adam Horowitz, Eddie Kitsis. But I would not recommend that above this. So anyway, that is Thought Far From Lucy. If you have a better answer of like some great movie or TV show that we're missing that an actor from Lost, and I'm thinking main, Michelle Rodriguez, that kind of that feels like not worth talking about.
Also, the answer is obvious.
Yeah, Blue Crush, duh. But email us, host this room podcast, if you have other thoughts or suggestions for Lucy's thought prompt there. And last but very not least, we've got another live watch, of course, next Saturday. It is the moment I've been waiting for from this season, the epitome for me, Ab Eterno. I will be hosting that live watch, come hell or high water or eyeliner. I'll be there. So that's it for me, I believe. And that just leaves me one question. Neil, what happened on Lost this week?
I would say that a few things happened on Lost this week. This episode, Recon, was written by Elizabeth Sarnoff and Jim Galasso, and directed by Jack Bender. It aired on March 16th, 2010, and it takes place on day 8, just day 8, following the arrival of Ajira Flight 316 on the island. On the aforementioned island, Sawyer, Jin, Kate, and Claire join Team Flock in the post-temple reshuffling. Even after learning the truth about the smoke thing, Sawyer agrees to go to Hydra Island to do some recon for the Man in Black. Upon arriving on Hydra Island, Sawyer takes a little trip down Bear Cage memory lane, then finds the Ajira plane, finds a pile of dead bodies, and is ultimately captured by Charles Widmore's people. They take him to the sub, where he cuts a deal with Chucky Wids to hand over Flock, a deal that he clearly has no intention of keeping because he immediately spills the beans to Smokey the moment he gets back to the main island. While Sawyer is away from Phlox's camp, Kate continues to try and figure out what's going on with Claire and Saeed, neither of whom are okay by any standard. And after Claire almost stabs Kate in the throat for taking Aaron, the man in black steps in for some therapy. As it turns out, he knowingly led Claire to believe that the other stole her baby in order to manipulate her. That's some antagonist stuff right there. In The Flash Sideways, Sawyer is there and he's putting his natural con man skills to work, but this time he's a cop. He's also still looking for Anthony Cooper, but he's withholding that information from his best friend, partner, and human lie detector, Miles. His partner, who adores him so much, she sets him up on a date with the lovely redhead named Charlotte. We've met her before. And while everyone is charming and the date seemingly goes pretty well, Charlotte does stumble upon a file folder full of Sawyer clues that causes James to freak out and completely blow it. Eventually, after being called out on his lies by Miles, James explains the Sawyer situation to his partner, and all is well until someone quite literally crashes into their tender moment, and guess what? It's Kate. The whole thing ends back on the beach, where Sawyer reveals his true plans to Kate by the campfire, very season one sort of deal. You see, he's not going to be helping Locke, and or Phlox, and he's not going to be helping Charles Widmore. He's going to steal that sub. Fun fact, I guess this is not actually a very fun fact about this episode, but it is true. This is the Lost episode with the second lowest Nielsen rating. It was only viewed by 8.9 million people. it beats out Follow the Leader, which is the lowest. That's an episode we've watched already. I believe that had 8.7 million viewers. So this one is the second least watched episode.
They put all that shirtless Josh Holloway on screen only and to get their second lowest rating.
So many series. People appear to have missed it.
They're lost.
This week's calm question, we're going to start with a little thing that happens in the middle of this episode. Have either of you ever been slapped or slapped another person? I ask this because I don't think I have. I definitely know that I have not slapped someone, and I don't think I've ever been slapped because I'm not much of a fighter, I guess, I don't have antagonist-y tendencies. And I've never tried to stab someone in the neck for stealing my baby. So I'm curious if, let's start with Dave. Dave, have you ever been on the receiving end or giving end of a slap?
I have not, by the grace of God, because Lord knows I've like deserved it. Actually, no, I'm going to tell this story. I'm sorry, Mom, but I did deserve it. It was like a some sort of party. I want to say it's like New Year's or something. I'm under the age of 10. We've just moved to Colorado, and we have like party hats, and we have like noisemakers, the like noisemakers that you blow into. And I was at the dinner table blowing my noisemaker. My mom's like, "Stop!" And I blow the noisemaker. She's like, "Stop!" She like blows the noisemaker. My dad's like, "Okay, you need to stop. Blow the noisemaker again." So my mom takes the noisemaker and then just sits on it. But what I see as a child is my noisemaker goes into my mom's crotch, and so I just immediately like just like reach in and just grab between her legs, and she instinctively backhanded me. And I think that's the only time I remember being like slapped.
All right. I mean, I feel like
don't grab people in the crotch ever. You know, that's what I should have learned. Actually, did learn. Don't think that I ever did that again. Joanna, save me. Have you ever been slapped?
Oh yeah, I mean plenty of times by my mom, but and my dad, but I once slapped a girl in first grade for I don't even remember. I think she like took some flashcards that I wanted to use. I don't know.
Long division.
Her name's Anjali. It was a big deal because her name was Anjali Elias. That I will always remember, and I definitely just cracked her across the face. And then like my lovely teacher, like instead of majorly punishing me, she like took me on a long walk and had a long conversation with me about like how sometimes feelings can feel like a volcano and like all this sort of stuff like that. And I just like, I remember forever. It was just like the perfect way to like respond to this. She didn't punish me. She just like talked to me about, you know, how we handle emotions.
She gave you the Mr. Rogers, what do we do when we feel mad inside?
Yeah.
That's lovely.
And I never slapped someone again. So it worked. So, I will always remember that as like, you know, I felt ashamed, but not like ashamed in a toxic way. Just sort of like, that was the wrong thing to do. And I know because this wonderful person who is, you know, taking time to like care for my emotional development is talking to me about it. So yeah, that's the time I slept on Jalea Lies in the first place. Now, if you want to hear about the time in fourth grade, when I need a kid in the crotch, that's a different story. For another
just moved
day.
On to other types of violence.
We had a fight out. Do you want to hear the story? I'll tell it really quickly.
Sure.
Sure. Yeah. Let's do the crotch violence segment.
Oh man. Now I can't remember his name and he went to high school with me, but, and once again, it was something really stupid. Like I think he took the chair that I wanted or something like that. And we like, were sort of arguing about it. And then two of our other friends who were like little shit disturbers were like, let's have a fight after school, basically in the box yard about it.
Oh man. And like 3 o'clock at the flagpole.
And I think they
like
sold tickets or not sold them, but at least like there were tickets involved. And, and we were like squared up to fight. And like, he was like a really nice kid. And I was probably a pretty nice kid, but maybe I was a bully. Anyway, my friend who was a guy like told me that I should knee him in the crotch, and we started, and I did, and I just kneed him in the crotch, and then the fight was over, and that was it, and I won. So
and then no one fucked with you ever again.
Yeah.
That's some real Bobby Hill energy. I love it.
His voice took a really long time to drop, and I don't think that I was responsible for that. But I just want you to know.
Aww, poor kid.
We went to school together until we were 18, so I just want you to know that that's the truth fact.
Wow. I mean, it's a different podcast than the Lost Podcast, but I'm enjoying this podcast.
Okay.
Guys, we are halfway through this final season of Lost. I don't know if we know much more than we did going in, but we're out of the temple. So, you know, things are looking up.
Wait, Neil, have you ever been slapped or slapped anyone?
I don't think so. Okay. I can't remember. I'm a notorious personal space respecter.
Yeah, I can't see you slapping anyone. Yeah, yeah.
I don't think I've ever slapped anyone. And I was, as a kid, I very quickly became larger than both of my parents. So, like, the best my mom could do would be to threaten to stand on a chair and hit me with a broom. Mm-hmm. She used to do that. She never hit me with a broom.
But
she'd always be like, I'm going to get up on a chair and I'm going to hit your ass with this broom if you don't knock it off.
I'm going to hit you. I'm going to hit you with this broom. Just as soon as I find a chair.
Then do it.
That's so cute.
Yeah. So, because, you know, she's a very short woman, as you can imagine.
I'm going to use that as a pivot point. This episode, sure. I think, does a little bit of conversing thematically between its sideways and its on-island activities. And I think has a lot of interesting ways of passing back and forth the theme that Phlox sort of tells Kate about why you lied to Claire, which is that, you know, occasionally there are times in your life where you could hold on to hate, and that could be the thing that you, you know, put in your engine to make yourself run. Doesn't seem very healthy. So my like initial question is, what are you guys' overall thoughts of Sideways Sawyer here? On one hand, seems to kind of have his shit together in certain ways. On the other hand, still has this big wound, and at the end admits he still plans to hunt down this man and kill him, which is more troubling to me because he was a cop instead of when a con man says that. But how are we feeling about it? Neil, how do you like Cop Sawyer?
One of the notes that I had about this is that it is interesting to me that there's a lot of discussion about the quality of Sawyer's ability to lie. Like, you know, on the island, the old Phlox is like, you're the best liar I've ever met. Whereas in the Sideways, it's like, he's still a pretty good liar. He's still got the con skills. But what's different is that he has this person in Miles who is clearly knows him super well, is clearly, you know, also like a good detective, very intuitive person, and he really just can't fool him in a way that, like, in the background of this episode, Miles is like unfurling all of his secrets in a matter of a couple days. And I found that really interesting. Like, he can fool people, but he can't fool this person who is clearly, you know, it's a quality of relationship that he didn't have, you know, in our sort of main timeline, you know, in his life before the crash. Maybe a little bit of that with Cassidy, like she knew him pretty well, but I think it's very interesting to see Sawyer James with someone in his life who sees right through it, you know, and that the addition of Miles is, I think, really great. You know, and it's fun to see them, I guess, in so much as it can be fun to see anyone as a cop. It's a fun flip of what we had from these guys previously.
Well, they do surprisingly little copping, and then the copping right. that we do see, we do have a question here that's all in caps. No, it's not all in caps. It's close to the one that's all in caps. I'm guessing this is Joanna. Is it legal to fuck someone when you're undercover? Joanna?
Seems dicey.
Does seem dicey.
Seems ethically very dicey.
That doesn't feel legal, right? I don't know. Entrapment, something. I don't know. I've never seen the film Entrapment, but I think all that Catherine Zeta-Jones is stick her posterior in the air. So, no, probably not. There's probably much more that happens in that movie. But,
I mean, I'm sure there are rules to being undercover. I'm sure there are plenty of cops that don't follow them.
It's, well, like, especially if it's like a something where like a bunch of people could burst into the hotel room at any given moment. Like if you're doing private recon and you decide that this is what you need to get your intel, I still don't think it's probably legal, but at least like I understand blurring the lines there. But like, this is wild. I mean, all for the sake of like the bait and switch of the audience of like, here comes Sawyer conning again. No, oh no, he's the cop this time.
He's the cop. Now I just can't not think of like Miles and those other dudes like sitting in a van.
Listening
in on Sawyer.
I mean, I have questions.
That also seems ethically dicey.
I have a lot of questions.
This is another, I think we've been tracking this definitely in the live watches. I think we've talked a little bit on the podcast of like another example of Lost not entirely knowing how real jobs work. You know, like doctoring or teaching or how like school administrations work in the last episode. This one is like, yeah, I don't think cops would do that.
No, I am confident that plenty of cops would do that. I'm just not confident that they would do it with their like friends in the van listening. I don't know. But maybe they would. To your question, Dave, I think it goes to another sort of point that I wrote down here, which is this idea of like, what the sideways storylines seem to be exploring, whether or not this is like explicitly what they're trying to do. They're kind of showing us like, what kind of destiny can these characters make for themselves without the island's influence, without, we presume, without like Jacob touching them, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And sending them on a certain path. For Ben, we find out last week that like, he can make quite a nice little life for himself without the warping influence of the island on him, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's just, like, a lot of good, like, he's just a nice little history teacher who has one little thought about deposing a shitty principal and then just doesn't
only
quite
do one Machiavellian scheme.
Yeah.
It's like a normal Thursday.
And it's, like, for the greater good, mostly, you know? So whereas Saeed is sort of, like, unfortunately like forever drawn back into this world that he's trying, like it's not the island's fault that Saeed is drawn back into a world of violence, right? It's mm-hmm. something else, some other force pulling on Saeed in that way. And then with James you get something sort of in between, right? Because you get the like, there was a fork in the road and I could be a cop or I could be a criminal. I decided to be a cop, which are also criminals sometimes. Anyway, you know, so you made that choice, but he still got this sort of like chasing his white whale stuff. So it's
he's still going to murder someone.
It's a mixed bag. Yeah. Follow-up question. What's going on with Anthony Cooper in this universe? If like is Sawyer not Anthony Cooper in this universe? Because Anthony Cooper has a good relationship with Locke, so like,
yeah, or is he just a former con man who has a good relationship with his son?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, presumably the inflection point is still the explosion of the nuclear bomb in the hatch. I'm just assuming because of, you know, time, we know that Roger Workman still went to the island. And then we also know from the fifth season that Sawyer was on the island for his parents' murder. So I still think we're in a possibility where it's like that all of that happened before like the 50s or whatever. Would it be unaltered by us blowing up a bomb on the hatch,
so
I would imagine?
In this version then, presumably, question mark, Anthony Cooper does all his dirty deeds in the 50s, etc., beyond 70s, 60s, 70s. But by the time he needs a kidney, whatever it is, he has seen the light. And, you know, he and Locke have that happy moment as they wake up in the hospital together. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like, I guess that's the moment. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, Anthony Cooper definitely has some explaining to do in Flash Sideways.
Either Anthony Cooper at some point changed his ways and, you know, went back and had a relationship with his son, or Locke just never found out he was lying. Like, that could also have happened, and, you know, he just got a kidney and stuck around, because how hard would that be?
That's what I mean.
So we got a couple of different options there, but it seems like Sawyer is going to be pretty close to Sawyer, because that, like, core hurt is still there for him. It's interesting that it's not there for him anymore on the island. So where we get the actual, like, text being spoken with Locke, you know, talking about you giving Claire something to hate, Sawyer is being driven not by hate. He just wants to get off the island. But I feel like it's almost as singular at this point.
I think it's complicated. I have a question for you guys, because I've, you know, at the beginning of this episode, when he's talking to Jin, he's like, he makes a promise to Jin, like, we don't leave unless Sun's with us. Like, if Sun's here, we're not leaving without her. And I believe him when he makes that promise. But it still feels like he's very much like, I'm running this on my own. I'm doing this. Like, because he tells Kate, I'm not with anyone, right? And which is, you know, connects to his whole walking away from the temple, rejecting being part of that little castaway society because of his heartbreak over Juliet. But I feel like his journey to Hydra Island, his visit to the dumb bear cage, his fondling of Kate's stupid little flower dress from that season and stuff like that, I feel like when he comes back and he's like calling her freckles and all this sort of stuff like that again, like, I feel like, I don't want to call it a rekindling of the love triangle, but I feel like he goes on and there's an emotional shift for him in terms of being part of a community versus not being part of a community within this episode. Do you guys agree or disagree about that?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I think it's almost entirely to like bring him back to this idea that like, okay, not only do I want to get off this island, but there are people I want to take with me, you know? So he's not, by the end especially, he's not, obviously not bought into helping either Widmore or the Men in Black. Like, he's hoping they just mutually destroy each other or whatever. Right. But his little, bear cage memory lane, at the very least, inspires him to not forget about his friends. So I guess that's growth, you know, especially, I guess, considering how out Sawyer was on all of the drama of the island after the death of Juliet, obviously, you know, that's growth back in the right direction, I think, you know, that he wants to help his friends. And I also believe him when he says that to Jin. It's like, it's very clear that like Sawyer has sorted out, at least with the people who are with Locke, like who he's gonna help and who he's not gonna help.
Yeah, I think we're back to like good group Sawyer. We're back to Sheriff Sawyer, which is like sort of how he operates best, where he's not the one necessarily making the calls. but he's the one enforcing the plan.
And hiding the guns in the jungle.
And hiding the guns. I just think it's even like less selfish than his previous goals have been. Because, you know, he used to have to kill Anthony Cooper, and then he did that. And then he, you know, tried to make a life with Juliet, but also kind of insisted that life still be on the island and feels guilty for, like, keeping her there. And now he's like, I'm actually going to help everybody while I'm helping myself. It seems like a slightly different recorder song from Sawyer.
Yeah, and I think that this idea of like what he's driven by, to your earlier point, Dave, is like, to me it feels like escaping a place where he shared any memories with Juliet, which is sort of like a theme that we've seen play out a couple different times. Like, for Juliet to want to reset the timeline because, you know, she says that thing where she's like, you know, if you never came here, then I never have to lose you or whatever. Or Jack wanting to reset everything because he fucked everything up with Kate. You know, like this idea that Lost keeps returning to, where it like comes down to these like relationship regrets that are driving these people to do these big things. And for Sawyer, it's like the pain of being on the island is the pain of the memory of his life with Juliet. And if he can just leave that island, he can kind of close the door on that chapter of his life entirely, maybe.
Hmm. And I also think it's evident of how Sawyer is no longer a person who is going to, like, think that they can fix any of the stuff that has happened. Right? Like, he's sort of crossed over into, like, basically, like, fuck this island territory.
Yeah.
So he's, you know, there's no, this version of Sawyer, I don't think would be remotely susceptible to Jack being like, I finally found a way to make this all work, you know?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. That's good. Cause I think, you know, he's slightly more useful when he has a focus of what he wants to do. And what he wants to do now is steal the sub.
All right, well, let's stick with Sawyer and probe some curiosities over in the Sideways, because right at the top, we talked about sleeping with the mark. I looked it up and was horrified to find out states are just now trying to make that illegal. You could totally sleep with people you're about to arrest. Isn't that fantastic?
Right.
Yeah, in some places, you could even have sex with them after you've arrested them. Isn't that great? So, yeah, thanks, real world. You just made Lost seem slightly better. But, yeah, clear that out. And completely not connected to that at all. Welcome back, Charlotte! I thought it was funny, Neil, you brought up Follow the Leader was the other lowest rated one, because that also has young Charlotte in it. So it's like Charlotte's the ratings indicator.
I'm not allowed to have chocolate before dinner.
Why didn't they let her have some chocolate before dinner? Over in the Sideways. All right, so we learn about Charlotte. Get set up on a date with Mr. Ford, Detective Ford. And it turns out that she is set up on a date because she works as an archaeologist in the museum with Miles' dad. So we found another ex-Dharma guy.
Take me to this museum.
Yeah. I wonder... Charlotte makes a reference to her being like Indiana Jones, or Detective Ford makes a reference about it. And that is apparently a reference to the logline for her audition, which was like a female Indiana Jones, is what they thought Charlotte the character was going to be.
Who did all of her best work in the parts of her life that we didn't see, I'm sure.
And then like apparently was trying to get in the entire time back to the island that she was born on. And then she did, and closed her own loop, which is very, very sad. But here she is, alive and well, having a pretty okay date with Sawyer. I mean, it seems, you know, pretty fast, but it's a TV show. We only have so much time. And then, sleeps with Sawyer. Joanna, read off the bingo card.
Oh. Sawyer is, I just came up with this. I think this is true, though. Sawyer is now the character who has officially banged the most regulars. He may have already held that title, but jeepers, it's Kate, Ana Lucia, Juliet, and Charlotte. Like, no one else has more than one, right?
Not that I can remember, yeah.
So
Jack just has the one. Yeah.
Jack just has the one. Saeed just has the one because Nadia is never a regular, right?
Well, and Shannon.
That's the one.
That's the one. You know, Rose and Bernard, Charlie and Claire, maybe Desmond and Penny. I guess, you know, it's like, no, it's just Sawyer. And like, when I wrote that, I actually wrote that out before I remembered Ana Lucia. I was just like, even at Kate, Juliet, and Charlotte, that's still a lot. Anyway, you know, good job, Sawyer.
Yeah. Also, I feel bad for Charlotte in this scene. I think that the scene where James flips out about her. First of all, he tells her top drawer on the right, and you don't see any t-shirts in there. So the man doesn't even know what's going on in his own dresser drawers.
Step one, get the woman a t-shirt if she asks for a t-shirt.
Yeah, just like get her a t-shirt. And then like that is a lot of very specific information to keep in a file folder in your top drawer.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this, I don't know, he could have told her the story. Like, he doesn't know that she's not cool or
well, he was
whatever.
I think he was thinking of maybe doing that when he came over, and she's like, too late, bub. And I was like, good for you, Charlotte.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I feel bad for her the way that date ends, 'cause they otherwise seem to have lovely time, but then very proud of the fact that she's like, nah. Take a hike, bud.
Take your LeFleur and get out of here.
Right.
That answers my other question that was in here, which is, what the hell is Charlotte wearing on this first date? Because she's got this like insane sequin halter mini dress. I mean, she looks beautiful, but it's like, is that what you wear to a first date?
I mean, if
female
even,
Indiana Jones, I don't
even
know,
before.
I don't think so.
Miles on the phone is like, she's a redhead, there any other redhead there? It's like, look at the room. That's the woman that's on a date. Like, just look at it.
But like, it's an insane dress. I'm sorry. Like, it's beautiful. It is insane. But now
my assumption is that she doesn't do a lot of dates because she's too busy being Indiana Jones.
And she's like, is this what human women wear? I don't know. Anyway. but it maybe it makes sense. Like, she definitely could not get back into what she was wearing for the date. She definitely needed a t-shirt. Because she wasn't about to put that sequin number back on.
Just to lounge around the bed.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's not a breakfast in bed outfit.
No, that's wild.
So, that's interesting. I wonder if the writer's room got deep enough into that, where it's like, well, she has to ask for something. Well, then let's put her in something she absolutely can't put back on. We can't have another Alana situation where she's just, you know, workable and ready to pull a gun on you at any time.
Sure.
What? Okay.
Right? No. it just seems like an interesting bit of reverse engineering that she needs to be in stuff she can't put back on.
I just think that at a certain point, a lot of the cast members were like, we've been dirty and in tank tops for 6 years on this show. Like when Saeed goes to Germany in what was it last season? Season before?
Yeah,
and he goes on that date and he's just looking just like he's going to catch on fire hot. I think that was part of the deal. Rebecca Mader is like, I will come back and do a scene for your little flash sideways, but I'm going to look hot.
And she does. She looks great.
And she does. Yeah. Good for her.
I want to sleep with Sawyer. What? Sure. Okay.
Yeah. And to his credit, even Detective James Ford cleans up nicely and is charming.
Yeah.
I mean, did we think he would not?
There was no doubt.
Maybe that could have been the sideways difference. Like, he looks like Sawyer, but he's just like the
awkward.
Nutty professor awkward.
Could you imagine if the sideways was like schlubby Detective Sawyer? Like, they made Josh Holloway gain like 30 pounds.
No, definitely. I mean, this is the dress version of every single like Brazilian blowout that Evangeline Lilly got in her LA season. But anyway, the dress is insane, but it for maybe for plot reasons. Moving on.
All right. Meanwhile, Cop Sawyer spills his guts to Miles, like we talked about. Miles says he's gonna try to talk him out of it, killing a person. Probably a good idea. But then smash, there's a car crash because Kate has apparently kept running. Maybe we thought last time we saw her, she, you know, had just left Claire, and we're like, maybe she's gonna, like, you know, be cooler. Nope. Still on the run. Still on the run for that murder she maybe did on the sideways. I don't think we ever locked down if it's true or not, but she's still on the run, and now Sawyer caught her, recognized her from the elevator. But that's since that's where we're ending.
She did, although whenever, however much time has passed between when she left Claire at the hospital, she did have time to put a hat on very tightly and mm-hmm. a hood up so that when she pops out of the car, we don't immediately recognize that that's Kate.
Yeah, we definitely don't. We definitely have no idea who that is running away.
Who would be running from the police in this universe?
Out of her blue Kia Sportage or whatever it is she's driving.
I do love Josh Holloway's, the way he plays that at the end, where he's just, like, what does he say? He's like, son of a bitch.
It's
got to
be a son of a bitch. I'm sure it is.
It's just great. Because it's great. It's very season one Sawyer, which is another thing that is kind of fun to watch for, is like, how close do they get to going back to the characters as they were on that flight, or in the immediate aftermath of that flight. So we get a little like Sawyer being a little too proud of himself at the end.
I also want to shout out to Sawyer's bachelor pad. What do you think?
Mm-hmm.
Number one, fridge, beer, freezer, frozen dinners, and it seems to only be the country fried steak frozen dinner. Like Detective Ford appears to only eat one single frozen country fried steak dinner every night.
Listen, some of us have been there.
That eating food is just a waste of time, and you need to just put carbs in your body.
Would you rank Sawyer's flash sideways apartment above or below Jack's sad single dad pad?
Oh no,
Jack has a better view, I think.
Yeah, Jack's is better. Okay. Single dad pad is better, and plus he like goes out for pizza, so he's not nuking country fried steak for David. and then nothing wrong with frozen dinner, by the way. Just like don't do me a favor, if you love frozen dinners, get a variety of them, and then I will feel happier about your life choices. Number two, Little House on the Prairie. Let's talk about it. Because mm-hmm. Sawyer has referenced Little House. Like, you get the sense in the way that Sawyer references Little House on the Prairie that he was, like, a total latchkey kid, right? Which he was, because he grew up, like, with no parents. so raised by the television, it seems. And I've always loved that about Sawyer, because my sister and I were also latchkey kids, and so, like, raised by the television. And so the way that, like, Sawyer talks about Little House is, like, almost being the thing that raises him. But the scene that they managed to find from Little House for this episode has Pa Ingalls talking about, like, even when people are dead, they're not really gone, and all sort of stuff like that. So I was like, it's so funny, because I kind of forgot what the scene was about. So when they queued it up, I was like, ooh, what juicy little, whose job was it to scroll through the Little House episodes and find something that would feel thematically resonant to this episode or to Lost? So I really liked that moment.
Yeah, it's a very nice touch.
Yeah, it makes him feel like maybe he could give Charlotte another try. It doesn't work, but, you know.
Listen, he goes on and he gets a fresh six-pack for her, right? He had already taken, like, drunk most of his six-pack. So he went out and bought her a fresh six-pack and a sunflower, which is, I think, actually a step up from the daisy that he brought to Juliet. And
it's
I'm
definitely
proud
larger.
Of her. And then he leaves the six-pack for her.
No, he leaves doesn't he leave the flower?
I thought he left the six-pack. Maybe he leaves a flower. I don't know. Anyway, hopefully he leaves both. He should leave both.
Anyway, he gave it a good effort, but Charlotte, listen, she's Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
She does not have time for this bullshit.
No time for Nazis or bullshit. There you go.
We don't know what happened to her when she had to get home at 3 a.m. and whatever in Los Angeles. So
in that dress.
Yeah, it could have been a nightmare. It could have been a nightmare.
All right. Anyway,
the before, lift wouldn't pick her up because she was leaving sequins everywhere.
Before rideshare, she had to take a taxi home.
She had to call a taxi service. Oh.
And then Kate showed up to pick her up in a taxi that she stole.
Wow. With the hood up and her ball cap pulled way down.
Kate's just working as a taxi driver now.
All right, we're going to go back to the island now. I'm going to save all the mommy issues for the end of the calm, and instead try to suss out what we learn with Sawyer here as we get on Hydra Island. Welcome, everybody, to the character we've been calling in the storm, like, knockoff Tina Fey, I think it was, but we get to meet Zoe.
Tina Fake.
Good, I love it. Zoe, who is pretending to be one of the passengers who we've seen, the remaining passengers of Jira Flight 316, have been massacred and taken up a residence on the island, is old Chucky Wids and his submarine crew, who are building like a sonic fence and have a plan, apparently, to kill Flock for reasons.
Sure.
Because, like Lost likes to do, they limit how much people explain to other characters. But since this is like in the final season, we actually know a lot about Charles Widmore. So even though Sawyer may not know why these two people are fighting each other, Neil, what do you think Widmore's plan is here?
Well, it's interesting that Widmore has now returned to the island. What I wonder is how much he knows about what has happened on the island since the last time he was relevant to our discussions, which was, it feels like when he and Ben had that like bedroom late night conversation, and he's like, I'm going to get you, Ben Linus. And Ben Linus is like, no, I'm going to get you first. And, because he has shown up to the island now several years later with a very specific plan to take down the Man in Black. And it's almost like he'd had never really mentioned that before as part of his thing. It really just seemed like it was Widmore versus Ben for control of the island. But now we get this, like, and this is where I guess it feels like a narratively like easy thing to do, to be like, oh, of course Charles knows about, you know, Jacob and the smoke monster and all this stuff. He was one of the others, but it does feel a little tossed in now. It's like, oh, like he's shown up and he's not here to turn this into Jurassic Park or whatever, I guess. He's just here to kill the Man in Black.
Well, okay. But I don't know that was always like my feeling is that Charles Widmore has learned new information since the last time he tried to come to the island. And so that he better understands the stakes of what's happening now.
Yeah, last time, I guess that makes sense.
Charles Widmore tried to get to the island, I was like, well, you know, he needs to like find a crew to do this stuff, but he needs to sink a plane so that like nobody finds it. Now it seems like he's just going to roll up, and Jacob told Hurley Stone was coming that this is the person that we've seen come to the island. So it does seem like, you know, he might have a little bit more, like, situation is different.
Yeah,
we're not
for sure.
We're not so much worried about driving a tiny boat out on a specific heading. We have to bring in the troops because Jacob's dead and things have gone to pot.
Can I quickly zoom back to Zoe really quickly?
Yeah.
Yes, please.
Zoe's played by actress Sheila Kelly, who I actually know. I, you know, calling her Tina Fake is funny, but like I knew her. She did a lot of work, TV work in the 90s and late 80s, I think, on L.A. Law, on Sisters. Like she had a big sort of juicy career in those shows. And then she's married to Richard Schiff of West Wing fame. And she runs a pole dancing studio, like pole dancing for, you know,
exercise purposes
sort of thing in L.A.
All right.
She's an interesting individual. And we're going to talk about her more as the season goes on, because she caused like quite a big stir with some interviews she gave around the final season. But yeah, Sheila Kelly is really welcome to the mix, Sheila Kelly.
Here's my question about Zoe. At what point do you think Sawyer figured out that she's not telling the truth? Right? Because they meet near the bodies, she gives him the whole story, and then they take a walk along the beach. And it isn't until the very end, it isn't until like the ninth question she asks that would have been red flags for me. Like she just starts asking all kinds of
specific probing. The guns.
Yeah.
That's when.
Okay. The guns.
But maybe he clocked it earlier. I don't know.
I almost feel like he clocked it immediately.
She's very dirt smeared. Like, she looks convincingly. Like, I don't know if she did that in the underbrush once she saw Sawyer coming mm-hmm. and just sort of like immediately started smearing dirt on herself so she could look like a survivor of a Jira.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And she's fairly convincing initially as being extremely like distraught over something. But especially once they're walking on the beach, she's asking way too many questions.
Yeah. She's no con woman.
You can't con a con man.
No.
Yeah. I feel like if I ever get like rescued by somebody and he's like, I'm going to take you back to my camp. I'm gonna have to really try hard to not ask the questions. How many of you do you have guns? Because I feel like I'd also want to know the answer to those questions. But don't know what
Maybe.
Situation I'm being kidnapped in, I guess.
But like, if you were still under the weight of the shock of having to, as she explains it, drag what seems like a dozen bodies,
mm-hmm.
Several hundred feet into the woods, I don't know if you'd be thinking about like guns and how many people are with it. I would just be like, oh my god, someone who is alive is here. Help me in any way
and
that you can.
He looks like Josh Holloway.
And he's a handsome guy who seems to have some sort of working knowledge of these islands.
Been here for a long time. Came on another plane. It's a long story. Yep. Good.
Have you seen the show Lost? Because that's the story.
That's the story of Lost. All right, I think that gets us everywhere we need to go with Sawyer, which leaves some other stuff that happens around the Man in Black and Kate and Claire. Overall, this episode seems to suddenly realize there's a flip side to Bad Dad and starts making some motions in the direction of maybe Bad Mom directly. In the speech that Flock gives to Kate about his mother, who mm-hmm. apparently is a very unbalanced woman, and has left him with a lot of issues that he is working through now. Very vague, and I think something you could say about a lot of people and technically be correct about, but it seems to hit a note with Kate because he directly connects this to Claire and Aaron. I don't like it, Joanna.
Yeah, I don't like it either. I don't like... Well, what part don't you like?
I like the idea that... I like the first part about hate. He admits that he lied, and he immediately says why he did it, and it makes sense to me. I don't like the play to try to get at Kate and Claire through motherhood, because it seems clumsy for the show.
Script-wise. Yeah, the thing that I do like about it is when he first starts talking, it's interesting because the description that he uses could be applied to John Locke as well, right? We met his mom as played by Swoozy Kurtz, another alum of the TV show Sisters, in an earlier season. We know that she is a mentally unwell woman. And so I think it's very interesting to draw parallels between Locke and the Man in Black.
Mm.
We've talked about that before in terms of like the way in which like is, I can't remember if we talked about in the con, but I think it's safe to talk about in the con, like this idea of like the longer you inhabit a body and all of its memories, like, do you then start to become more like that person? Is the Man in Black becoming more like John Locke the more that he's inside John Locke's body? And so, like, anyway, so, like, you know, I don't love everything that they do around Kate and Claire and motherhood and stuff like that, but it is at least they're starting to pay attention to mothers as opposed to making it all about dads. But mostly I like that parallel between John and the Man in Black. What do you think, Neil?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the good part. I think that the stuff that they're trying to connect between characters they go from like this like generic bad, it's they go from bad dad, not from bad dad to bad mom, but from bad dad to like crazy mom. And they, you know, they, the use of the word crazy is a little much, but it is, it's like they pivot specifically to like moms who are clearly going through some sort of mental health crisis. Whereas like the dads are a little more varied, right? Like some of the dads just disappear. Some of them are like verbally abusive, and but it seems to be keying in on this very specific kind of, you know, mom in crisis, which, you know, I don't know, doesn't necessarily feel as nuanced as it could be. Also, we've been tracking a little bit whether or not our guy, the man in black, old Smokey, can lie. And in this one, this is a pretty big lie that he cops to. The idea that he was the one who sort of steered Claire toward her current state of existence by telling her that the others stole her baby. I mean, I guess he probably could have accomplished it. Claire still would not be great if she had known that, like, Kate took her baby off the island from the beginning. But he definitely made the situation worse.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not fun for Claire. You know, that's some antagonist behavior toward Claire, who, really, she just set her baby down on a leaf. She was going to come back for him.
She swears. yeah, there's a lot of gaslighting in Claire in this episode.
You kind of see how Claire got there, right? Like, Claire's not just been alone in the woods for this many years. She's been manipulated constantly by this figure. And we see him slap her, and then also, like, you know, we've heard about how he's lied to her, and we hear him emotionally manipulate her in this episode. So it's, you know, poor Claire. And I guess my question is, like, at the end when she apologizes to Kate and, like, hugs her, like, do we believe Claire in this one? I'm tempted to, only because I feel like Lost is the kind of show where they would, like, have cut to Emily DeRaven's face making, like, an evil
sinister grin.
Yeah, something like that if she were
lying.
She
just goes and sits next to Saeed, and they both stare off into the distance at a tree.
Oh, my God, Saeed.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's something that we definitely want to believe, but it's hard to believe that Claire is making her own decisions at this point.
I would say, if there's any doubt in my mind, it's more like, you know, she's actually been physically struck, and so she knows she did bad, so she's going to immediately correct that behavior. My hope is that it grows into, like, a full apology or whatnot, but it definitely didn't read. I was a little nervous for the hug when it happened.
I mean, I definitely think Kate is sleeping with one eye open.
She should all the time.
That evening, or with some sort of weapon near her, just in case, because that was pretty traumatic for Kate, having Claire almost stab her in the neck, and looking at Saeed, and Saeed being like, let's see how this turns out.
That's actually one of my favorite bits of acting that Evangeline Lilly does in this entire series, is when she's trying to talk, when Kate's trying to talk to Saeed, and he's being so weird, and she's like, are you okay? And he's like, no. And she's like, where am I? What have I gotten myself into? I just tried to help Claire, but I've seen her squirrel baby now. Saeed's being super weird. What's going on?
Yeah. I've Kate made is a having mistake. A wild day.
Oh my gosh.
Sawyer's back on the team, and he's calling her Freckles. This is must be just like a whirlwind of a day for Kate.
That's true.
They're also doing that makeup thing that they do sometimes with Evangeline Lilly, where they put, like, some red underneath her eyes. Like, you know, she's got the, like, usual smattering of dirt, but she's also got this, like, red. And I feel like it's been there since, like, the crying a couple episodes ago with Sawyer. So, like, let's...
Well, no, she has a good cry in this episode, too.
Yeah, let's get Kate a nap and a sandwich, maybe. Like, you know? That's what I think.
Well, apparently they're going to be at this camp for a few days, according to Flock. So, yeah, nap and a sandwich sounds good. And before we go out, there's one more substitute mother figure on the island that we get to check in with this episode, because Cindy's back with the kids.
I mean, I put this in the notes because, listen, when we met the tail section of Oceanic A15, did we ever think that the most relevant people in the final season would be Cindy and the kids? No, we did not. But here they are. Zach, Emma, and Cindy are still relevant. Bernard's who knows where. Like, Bernard, who was after Anuncia, Libby, and Echo all were taken off the board, Bernard was like, okay, well, at least one of the tailies is significant, but he's fucked up to the jungle with Rose, presumably. So, like, Cindy and the kids? Fun stuff. I love it.
Tail section endures. Somehow.
Still around.
I do have actually one more thing before we go, which is something I stumbled across, which is I was reading Alan Sepinwall's of this episode, and he talks about how he was emailing with Mike Schur about what was going on at Lost in this moment. And so, like, let's just contextualize who Mike Schur is at this point in time. He was a writer, an occasional guest star on The Office, and he just launched the first season of Parks and Recreation, which you may recall was not a very well-watched show in its first season. So Mike Schur isn't really Mike Schur yet.
He is yet to assemble the Schurverse.
Right, exactly. So I just want. So he has a theory about what the Flash sideways is. Do you guys want to hear a Mike Schur theory?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. And Alan wrote, Mike Schur, co-creator of NBC's Parks and Recreation, currently the best sitcom on TV and one you better be watching if you aren't already, and not just because of this mustache. I mean, like, I love that Alan Sepinwall has to, like, make the case for Ron Swanson in the year of our Lord 2010. All right. So Mike wrote, I think the alt's present scenes are an attempt to show what each character's true nature is, absent any situation where the island draws them more towards either Smokey or Jacob. This didn't occur to me until last night, but it felt like they were saying, Ben is an intellectual guy searching for meaning in his life, frustrated by powerlessness, and thus capable of Machiavellian manipulations. But inherently, when push comes to shove, he is decent, which is why in the island reality, he chooses at that crucial moment to steer away from Smokey and back to Jacob. Saeed, on the other hand, is something inherently violent and evil in him, which is why in the all present he killed those guys, and on the island gave himself over to Smokey. Jack is deeply conflicted about his father and has it in him to be angry and conflicted, but in the all present he is inherently interested in being good father himself and breaking the cycle of emotional abuse. So in the island reality, he is on Team Jacob and so forth. I think they are quote-unquote influencing what is happening on the island only in as much as they show us what these people truly are in the truest existential sense. Their actual natures are at play in the alt futures, and those teetering between good and evil natures, I guess you could say, are what Jacob, quote-unquote, saw somehow, and they're what led him to determine that they are, quote-unquote, candidates. That moment where Smokey picked up the white rock off the scale and tossed it out the door is more fuel for this theory. They pick people who are perfectly balanced between bad and good, and bring them to the island as a sort of laboratory to determine which of those forces wins out in the end. So the events that are occurring in the island present, the lost version of the stand where sides are being drawn, are the result, though not really obviously in the causal sense, of the alt futures, wherein we are seeing that left to their own devices, each of these people tilt slightly to one side of the good/evil equation. So that's Mike's encapsulation of that. I think my main quibble with that
is Dogen's machine.
I just don't like characterizing Saeed as inherently evil.
Yeah, that's
I hate it, in fact.
And I don't think it's Mike Schur's fault. It's definitely the show's fault.
Yeah.
Because Saeed, we know that he contains many multitudes and is not inherently evil. But I do like the part of the theory where it's like the reason why they're candidates is because there's something about them that could go either way.
Yeah.
You know? And I guess that might be true of all of us, really.
Well, or if it's not, we're just like, Jacob looks at us and it's like, Dave Gonzalez, that guy's evil. Let's not do that.
Yeah, it's not all of us remember because it's either Jin or Sun, but not both of them. I think we all know that it's Jin. Sun is a dark avenging angel.
Right.
Sun killed Smooth Boy and got a daughter out of it. That's all worked out.
All right. So that's the Mike Schur theory of the case. But I'm love curious it. What you guys think. And like, I would love to get some emails as we struggle, like, trying to figure out what Lost is trying to say about binary good versus evil in the end here.
Yes. Slight spoiler, it does not get more clear cut before it gets more in the weeds. So please send your emails if you have an idea. It would be very helpful. All right. It's time for the corners. Neil, we got two Giacchino corners this week.
Oh, boo. Yeah.
not particularly inspiring work from Giacchino. Two little ones. Maybe he knew in advance that this would be the second lowest rated episode of Lost, because there's a track called Recon, which is a composition ultimately kind of based. It mixes Claire's motif and Danielle Rousseau's motif, and then they play it over Sawyer walking by the plane. So the Ajira plane, it's really hard to tell sort of what he's going for there. He just named it after the episode. And then Crazy Town, which again, not a huge fan of Lost's desire to use that particular C word.
I feel like you could improve it if you make it a pun. Like if it's like riding the crazy town or crazy train. No, sure. See that, you know, I mean, no. It's
yeah, and this is the piece of score that plays while Kate and Smokey are having their conversation about the Man in Black's mommy issues.
Yeah.
So
it could have been Smoking Moms.
This is another one of those like expected more from Giacchino on a naming level.
Yeah, come on. There's so many good puns. Our jungle of mystery moment is, I think, the same one that Sawyer points out for us on the sub. What's in Widmore's locked room? It's three padlocks on that guy. Yeah, snacks. All the Widmore snacks. All the Apollo bars. The dumb, elaborate artifact of the week goes to our bear cages. They built that whole set again, I'm assuming, because, like, right?
I can't believe it. I mean, I think, didn't someone say, like, they filmed that at the zoo? I don't know. Anyway, like, when they showed the wide shot, I was like, they built the whole thing again? Wow.
Yeah. And they found that dress.
How long has it been? 3 years?
At least 3 years,
okay,
right?
Okay, that is some synthetic fabric that lasted that long. And I believe it. Ben Lettice only springs for the best rayon dresses for his weird breakfast beach captors.
I prefer to think that it's Tom that knew the quality.
Oh, yeah. He's, like, picking out the good dresses.
Mm-hmm.
The Boone Carlyle Memorial Falling Down Award is going to go to Kate, who's about to get a knife in the neck. Just as a very notable fall. Maybe not winning by distance, but that's what you get if you have a notable fall like that. And Saeed just does nothing.
Is she in the sitting position? Is she on the log and then Claire just like jumps
at her?
She stand up and Claire lunges at her. Anyway, it's a moment. It's a real moment for Claire, who once again could use a nap and a sandwich.
The John Locke Memorial Coming Back Award. Hey guys, Liam Pace was in this episode trying to get Charlie out of jail for being arrested.
My brother? My brother?
And then you're like, oh man, is Charlie going to be in this episode? Not yet.
What was it? Saeed and they walked by Jack in the hallway at the hospital sort of thing. It's just a sort of a little like fun.
Real Charlie tease here.
They're so close.
Yeah.
I guess I'm out of the book club. We get a Watership Down callback. It's on the book, Sawyer's side shelf that he hides his secrets in. It's at the top of his stack of books. He still loves those rabbits. Even
I forgot to look. Are all of those books that Sawyer
read on the island?
Also read on the island? We'll have to do an in-depth on that.
Gonna have to go frame by frame.
I'll take a look.
Is that blank covered red book in there? That we never figured out what it was? That'd be sweet. The ABS Eterno Award goes to the cop that needs to have sex on the job and apparently can be viewed by anybody at any time. Detective Ford, keeping it tight in the ABS area.
We get two big ABS shots. Two big ABS related scenes in this episode, both for James Ford.
I mean, yeah, I was watching the episode earlier today. You know, I'm a friend and I are staying in a sort of small space. So she like walked by and I like paused it. It's just like shirtless Sawyer. And mm-hmm. she knew what I was watching, but she's like, that is quite the freeze frame. I was like, listen, man, my job is hard. It's tough.
Fringe it benefits. Pausing on shirtless Sawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Through the looking glass, this is where characters glimpse themselves in the mirror. This one, we really accented because not only does Sawyer look at himself, he does a classic television mirror punching. Gotta love it.
Good old mm-hmm. mirror punch.
Ben's talking, so it's obviously a lie. Ward goes to Detective Ford, who says, Palm Springs, when he went to Australia. I feel like that's just, like, completely different times. So, like, yeah. Anyway.
And a lie that is easily discovered by his detective partner, who can just run his credit card, which is apparently a thing. I don't know if that seems illegal as well. Like, just running someone's credit card information randomly, but... he is a cop and he knows how to do it, so
it's true.
I don't understand. I mean, other obviously the plot reasons, but it just doesn't feel like he could have told Miles a long time ago about this this quest of his.
Here's the sorry.
Oh, I was gonna say, honestly, great job keeping it from Miles this point far, because mm-hmm. it seems like they really know each other, but this
and
the
lie really
Australia
falls apart
trip?
Quickly.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jonah.
The stack of books in Sawyer's room are Watership Down, A Wrinkle in Time, and Lancelot, all of which were read by Sawyer on the beach in a previous season.
Aww, so no matter what reality you're in, you're still going to read the same books. That's kind of nice.
That is nice.
Sure.
Every version of Dave has read House of Leaves. all right, spot the difference quarter. James Ford, cop. Big difference. Large difference. Cop, con man, traditionally not on the same side of the coin. But here we are, apparently, just with, like, as Michael Schur says, with the balances left up to their own devices. It takes a cop to hunt down Anthony Cooper, apparently. Effectively. That's sure. That's gonna be my good way of looking at it. It's not that anybody is inherently a cop in their heart. I don't believe that. It's that should you want to solve a murder, being a cop would probably be a step closer to that. That logic I could follow. Still don't think you should murder the dude if you're a cop, though, but, you know, we'll get there. No! It's time for the Jungle of Kistery. This is where we decide who needs to be kissing on the island. Last week, we had a Dr. Linus episode with some surprising results. Joanna, who's kissing?
Listen, I don't know if this person has ever won the Kistery poll, especially given his long history of unpopularity among our listeners. But as I have been saying for years, the worm kind of turns on this character in the final season. So we've got some options here. We've got Ars and a better parking spot. Only got 15.5% of the vote. Sorry, buddy. Miles and the Diamonds. From the Jabronis, only 21.8% of the vote. But I kind of believe in Miles. I feel like Miles and Jim, buddy cops, could make it Kistery poll this week.
I mean, everybody. I'm don't know because we're recording this before the live watch. But I'm guessing it's going to be a very Ford/Sawyer heavy poll.
Yeah, but I don't think anyone's going to be rooting for, like, Charlotte or that lady, the con lady at the beginning of the episode. I feel like it's going to be Miles, but we'll see. We'll see what our listeners do. All right, Ben in power plays, 24.1% of the vote. If Ben was going to win a Kistery poll, surely he would have done it in the Dr. Linus episode where he was a nice guy, but no, surprisingly, and nominated by the very lovely Kevin Gonzalez, it is Jack and Richard over some sweaty dynamite, 38.5% of the vote. Jack Shepard has won a Kistery poll. Boom goes the dynamite of Jack Shepard's character arc.
Yeah,
coming.
It just took
to
it took some tension on an old wooden ship in order to make it happen.
It took a helping
Jack.
Hand from Richard Alpert. Let's be honest.
Yeah,
like Richard. Richard's a big boost in any category. Anyway, so there you go, Richard and Jack, KISSING.
I hope we could carry some more Richard and Jack going forward. That seems good. I would like to see the immortal man kiss the new man of faith. Very pleased. Good job, Kevin. All right, DeFrank, Lapidus. Guess we're not going to Guam. Act Break Award goes to Sawyer, who says, all right, you got me. Take me to your leader. When being caught by Zoe and Widmore's men.
Yeah, no one... first of all, I noticed on my rewatch how much bigger Josh Holloway seems than all the dudes who show up after Zoe like sends out the whistle. Like, why did Widmore bring all these like small dudes? But no one gets caught like Sawyer. Like, just the confidence of being like, yeah, you got me. This is all part of my plan. It's chill. I'm Sawyer. You're on my island. Like,
that's what's in the locked room in the sub is the one large gentleman they brought.
The one large person they brought.
Time to break out the enforcer. All right. I think there is no official podcast this week. There was a video about Josh Holloway talking about his sideways character. There will be one next week because, spoiler alert, in the time travel of Lost's actual production during this season, when this episode aired, they were still writing the finale. Next week, they will have finished writing the finale and be just into shooting and post-production and stuff. So hopefully we'll be getting some more official podcast check-ins as past Damon and Carlton figure out what the end of their series is going to be. If you already know what the end of the series is going to be, you could join us in the storm right after this.
All right, now is the time on the podcast where we like to thank our Small Council subscribers. Those are the folks who have contributed at the $10 level or above. They get all the content. Let's start with some new folks. We've got Dana Quinley, Lauren Hunter, Laura Fairbanks, Danielle Wilkinson, Anya Susan Samness, Diana Fisher, Sam Williams, Delia Vosch, Beth Weingarner, Mike Harris, Matthew Wilson, Grayson Owen, Guava Corvallis, Emily Ann, Lauren Adams, Heather Carpenter, Caleb McKee, Crystal Rice, Jillian Walsh, and Catherine. Thank you all so much.
And I would like to add to that thanks, Sarah Trites, Aaron Goerwerk, Paula Silva, Allison Heishman, Andrew Bird, Kelsey Lee Measure, Alex, Matt Pilari, Peter Hobson, Lisa Romney, Lawrence Medina, Serafina Cobin, Justin Way, Lorenzo Ciandra, Monica Wolf, Fainting Violet, Andrea Rodriguez Garcia, Taylor Granger, James, and Dan Pozo. Thank you guys very much.
And I would like to thank the following fine humans: Stephen Lear, Jess, Amy, Mother of Dragons and Breaker of Chains, Amanda Rhodes, Natalie Gershman, Susan Monk, Lindsay Mitchell, Ernesty? Yeah, I think that's right, I guess. Lex Gernon, Svevir Sigvason, Mitch, Felidia Featherbottom, Matthew Punamali, Heather Todd, Alex Winkus, David Rinna, and Jack Sinclair. Thank you all for being members of the Small Council.
And we're back for the storm. Hit me with those pews.
Pew, pew, pew.
Yeah.
Hey, do you know? Okay, so I did a little guest stint on the Ringerverse last week. Mm-hmm. Something that I found out, I haven't listened to it yet, but like the Ringerverse Marvel shows that they're doing, they do a show called The Midnight Boys, where two fine culture writer podcasters do like an instant react to the episode. And apparently they do a pew pew, and I don't think I invented the pew pew, but like I was a little like, because I was talking about it, I was like, hey, how are the Midnight Boys, and everyone went pew pew, and I was like, wait, is that their thing? That's our thing. Anyway, you guys let me know if you're listening and you also listen to Midnight Boys. Are they pew-pewing? Are they pew-pewing?
Should we have a pew-pew-pew off?
Yes.
In order to settle this?
Do they have keychains?
I do have a keychain that says pew-pew-pew on it. Anyway. All right. I got a lot of emails, actually, that I would love to.
Okay, then I have one question, and we have a few questions in here, and then we'll close out with emails. My one question here is, if we go off the thing we've been talking about in the storm a little bit, which is the sideways is like an invented reality that has to do with like hopes and fears, is Sawyer having a friend his fear or his hope gift he gives himself.
Oh, I love that. I think it's his hope.
Mm-hmm.
You think Miles is like his, like, I wish I had a detective buddy. And Miles is like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that, like, his time as LaFleur was so important to him. And, like, we'll get to the Juliet of it all. But, like, that's the thing is, like, these times that were so important to these people, like, they can't have their soulmate there. So, like, he's got the rest of LaFleur going on. He's a cop and Miles is his partner. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, like, all he needs is the right girl. Charlotte's nice, but she's not the right girl. So we'll get there. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and I think it works for both his relationship to Miles and his relationship to Juliet. It's like the thing that Sawyer resists through much of this, much of the show is human connection and being sort of open and vulnerable and like really being close to someone. And as LaFleur, he is close to Juliet, obviously, but he also develops this friendship with Miles. And I think it's interesting for them to bring that back. And it's like the thing that Sawyer hoped for himself, I guess, is, you know, having people that know him extremely well, you know, because that's not something that season 1 and 2 and 3 Sawyer is ever really interested in, you know?
Yep. It's the difference for Sawyer is having somebody, you know, like on that journey with him. And then I guess last thing I want to say about Sawyer is props for Joanna for planting that little house scene in everybody's mind, because I had forgotten how much it was like, and just in case you want to go back
on the nose.
Yeah, figure out what the sideways is. Hey, we have this little house that tells you. It's pretty great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I try not to put my foot too hard on the gas, but I'm glad.
No, it was good. You also connected to the latchkey thing, kid thing, which made me think, like, I don't know what the shorthand is for the little house or the Freaks and Geeks, like, laughing at Gary Shandling. Like, what does a latchkey kid go home to watch these days?
More TikTok, I guess.
Yeah.
Just the apps. They're not watching
Joe Rogan
shows.
On YouTube.
Oh, son of a bitch.
Aww. Oh, boy.
No, I bet you're right. That's sad. well, it makes me feel better about the ones I meet in the afternoon in Fortnite when I'm getting renders done and need to blow off some steam.
All right. Yeah.
The blurring of Locke and Smokey, I think you touched it a little bit in the calm.
I did in the calm, yeah.
And our old boy Desmond has been forced back into a hole by Charles Widmore. He's behind the locked door.
Yeah, speaking of things people didn't deserve, Desmond did not deserve to be dragged back to this fucking island.
Well, I just love that, like, he's back in the hatch. The best answer to a mystery is Desmond.
It is Desmond in a hatch.
All right, so let's hit these emails. The first one is from Chris B, titled Jacob's Deadly Mommy Issues. And he says, hey, hope this finds you well. A combination of my series you watch and a recent tweet by podcast all-star and all-around awesome human Kristen Russo led me to ask this question. Is Jacob punishing women living on the island to work out his mommy issues, or is he just a misogynist? A few points to consider. After the incident, almost all women die in childbirth. That's a very specific and arbitrary effect for an EM catastrophe, almost as if the incident had nothing to do with it and it's just Magic Island bullshit set down by someone with an agenda. Number two, the island healing effect has been shown to be very selective, Locke versus Ben's spinal issues, so why can't the island heal pregnant women in distress? Can it be someone on the island doesn't want them to be healed? Number three, insult to injury, men apparently have massively increased sperm counts, so a sexually active woman with a male partner living on the island is almost guaranteed to get pregnant. Number four, people aren't supposed to leave the island, so if a woman gets pregnant, sucks for her, apparently. Number five, being a mother means you can't be an island god or maybe just a woman in general. Seems like there are very few female candidates anyway. These are just a few things that sprang to mind. I'm sure there are plenty of others. Thanks for the pod. Can't wait to see what you all deep dive into next. All the love, Chris.
Mm.
So, is Jacob a misogynist? Or are the Lost Riders misogynists? Or, like, what's going on here?
I mean, they're... First of all, I love a Jacob antagonist check-in, because he's definitely the fucking bad guy of this whole show. And it's definitely... What's interesting is that the first mention, I guess, of Jacob and the Man in Black's mother comes from the Man in Black, and it's all about how poorly it went. And so it feels like Jacob taking this trauma from his life, from his whatever human life he had, right? And passing it on to the island. Like, now the island has mom-related trauma. So yeah, I guess in that sense, that falls under the technical definition of misogyny. But I definitely think it's also about, like, the fallibility of having, like, an island god, I guess, and the fact that, like, even Jacob, who's supposed to be this all-powerful god-like figure, still has baggage and trauma that he is going to unleash upon anyone he's controlling, you know?
I have a lot of reproductive rights questions about the island. if men are jacked up on their sperm count and women die in childbirth, what are the...
And there's no Planned Parenthood on the island.
Yeah. It's Dharma doesn't have... Anyway, I have a lot of questions. All right, Dave.
I'm going to blame the writers because sure. I do think Jacob is a misogynist as a character answer feels good, but that's a result of, like, plaque on the arteries. Like, each one of these are individual problems they made for themselves by thinking it wasn't a problem, and it compounds to this giant actual problem. I want to give them some credit in that I don't think they go into the final season not, like, thinking they're doing a benevolent god and actually doing an asshole god. Like, I think they know they're doing an asshole god, but asshole god being the person that gives us the most definitive answers we're going to get means that you have to shorthand things like Rousseau is the echo of this crazy mom who wasn't actually, like, that crazy, but, like, the island trauma, like, echoes it so that, you know, all the moms are crazy, or, you know, you have very selective moms who are capable of giving birth, or all these things. All those things are story problems they had to write their way out of, and they wrote their way out for an episode or two. When you look at, like, the full completion of it, it's, I think we talked about this last week, but it's like Damon and Carlton, like, not thinking about who was going to breastfeed Aaron on the, you know, way back when they were the Oceanic Six. And them sort of, like, laughing it off will be like, well, also the island's fantasy. It's like, no, you just had no one in the writer's room who was bringing that reality to your characters. Not, it's different than somebody bringing that reality and you deciding it's not important. If someone brings it up after the fact, it means you missed it. And that's, I mean,
what's interesting is, like, you know, they Elizabeth Sarnoff did write a lot of Lost, and I'm not saying, like, having one woman or a few women, like, writing your show inoculates you to that, but I'm like, at least it's not the Thrones writer's room, which was four dudes for most of the back few seasons. So but you know, in the end, I'm curious about the origin of, like, women have trouble bringing babies to terms on this island idea, because it's seeded so early.
I mean, it has to be because why? Kate is a pilot episode character, and they're like, here's Kate, or not Kate, I'm sorry, Claire is a pilot episode character. It's like, not only are we just inherently scared because she's pregnant, but there's a timer on the rescue. So surely that'll make for good story. And J.J. Abrams is like, and away, I'm off to do movies. And then it, you know, has to become a Damon Carlton show. And they are like, well, we don't have any good stories for not pregnant Claire.
It's true. All right. This email comes from Ryan. It's called More Knife Stuff. And he says, so Claudia, the mother of Jacob and the Man in Black, shipwrecks to the island about 1 A.D., if Lostpedia is to be believed. The name and time frame couldn't be accidental. Claudia is the name and wife of Pontius Pilate, and she had a vision about Jesus and warned her husband against his execution. As for Lost, we have Claudia shipwrecking on the island and speaking Latin, and now there's a dagger from Roman legionnaires in play.
Oh!
It makes sense if there's a Roman shipwreck, and then this would wind up on the island along with Claudia, who gives birth to the island Jesus and island Satan.
Right. This is it. We're making Roar canon in the Lost universe.
Where's Heath?
Yeah, the spear. The spear. I love the knife is the spear. Is what that email? I got really excited.
I mean, it just it makes a little bit more sense. I hadn't thought about her name, and that's great. We're talking a lot about Alice and Janney. We're getting excited for her to get here.
Yeah.
Okay.
For non-Christians, there's supposedly one of the mystical objects created by the crucifixion was the spear that stabbed Jesus to test if he was really dead. It's in the Bible, blah, blah, blah. It's like a Shroud of Turin level artifact where it's like, yeah, maybe that's probably not the thing, but I understand why it's important to Indiana Jones's.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's the kind of thing that both Indiana Jones and Charlotte would go looking
exactly.
For.
All right. Saeed Ramblings from Charlie. Hello to my favorite podcasters. Hi, Charlie. I'd like to quickly say how much I enjoy the podcast. Lost is one of my favorite shows, so when y'all announced a Lost rewatch, I was excited and really enjoyed my return trip to the island with you all. I hope you'll indulge a few thoughts on Saeed, especially regarding his relationship with Shannon and with Nadia. I'll begin by saying that Shannon and Saeed never worked for me as a couple. I always felt that Nadia was his great love. However, the finale says otherwise, so my lizard brain needs to make sense of why Saeed ends up with Shannon in the church beyond just Maggie Grace agreed to return. Ha! In the scene with Flock, Saeed never directly says that he wants Nadia back. What he says is that the thing he wanted most died in his arms. The audience assumes he means Nadia, but Shannon also died in his arms, probably not that far from where he and Locke are speaking. It would be another bait and switch from the writers. We are thinking about Nadia, but since he never said her name, he could have meant Shannon. Or perhaps they both represent what Saeed really wanted, a peaceful life with someone he loved. A flash sideways indicates that person isn't Nadia, though, and was never meant to be her. Nadia is directly connected to the darkest parts of Saeed's life that resulted in him believing he's a bad person, unworthy of love and happiness. When he was a torturer during her life and his time as Ben's assassin after her death, Shannon, on the other hand, is the person who gave him a fresh start on the island. It is until he starts to let go of Nadia in the sideways that he and Shannon wake each other up, and he finally finds the peace that has eluded him for so long. That's the best way I can make sense of why he ends up with Shannon in the church. Anyway, thanks for indulging my ramblings and never tighten up. Best regards. Charlotte. Sorry for saying Charlie. I guess probably you go by both. Anyway, Charlotte. So I love this. This is the most sensical read I've ever heard on why Shannon and Saeed. This idea of Shannon being the, like, what, the second wife, the, like, the do-over mm-hmm. wife, the, like, I'm going to get it right this time. And that she's connected to a time in Saeed's life where he was trying to have a fresh start away from everything else. I don't know. I
never really connected Nadia's trauma to Saeed's trauma and the fact that they're sort of like supposed to be star-crossed lovers as fucked up before, but it is kind of fucked up now that I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've never... Because
he literally tortures her at one point.
Exactly.
I've never dated anybody I've tortured.
No, this one, this makes a lot... I like this a lot. This makes a lot of sense. And or is the best way to explain... the Shannon in the church thing, other than Maggie Grace was willing to come back.
Maggie Grace is available. Also, FYI, guys, I don't know if you can hear it, but it just started to like majorly rain where I am, and I'm not necessarily a soundproof area. So if you're hearing that in the background, you're not.
Rain in the storm, uncharacteristic.
Literal storm coming to get you.
All right, this last email comes from Ryan M. And he writes, Joanna, I didn't know when to write this email, so I figured I'll send it now. As we approach the end of the series, I find myself revisiting the idea of how to improve the ending, and I keep coming back to the idea that the incident should have been the series finale of the show. Season 5 would need to be reworked slightly to make it work, but the incident, which was discussed in Season 2, always fit well in the flow and progression of the show. It was a logical ending. Changing the format for a third time, especially when they chose to make a drastic shift in their approach to storytelling, confused audiences. My quick rewrite would make Season 5 be the final season, but extend it back to 24 episodes to give it breathing room. The fake John reveal and subsequent Jacob death can be moved up to episodes 17 through 20 range, so the good aspects of the aftermath in Season 6, Abiturno, etc., can still be... Okay, good. Sorry, I skimmed this episode earlier and my rebut was, but Abiturno, yeah. But it's in here. Okay. Abiturno, etc., can still be kept, but the silly things, the temple, etc., could be cut. Defeating the man in black would then be tied to the incident somehow. Maybe resetting the timeline saves Jacob, something like that. The incident would then be the penultimate episode, which brings the two timelines back together and the characters back together finally for the two-hour series finale. Juliet doesn't need to die in the incident in this scenario unless the writers just want to be cruel, and there is no Sopranos-esque abrupt ending either. My question to you is, what season 6 connection or event that you enjoyed would you lose in the scenario? You can still have the Jin and Sun and Kate and Claire reunions. You can still have Jack and the group emotionally dealing with the death of John Locke. You can still make the ending about bringing everyone together and making them realizing their connections to each other is what got them through this traumatic event. Love to hear your thoughts. Thanks, Ryan. Okay, I thought I had my rebuttal ready, which was Averno, but Ryan cleverly allowed for that. So I don't know. What do you guys think of this reworking?
I think I do enjoy the Flash sideways, and I can see the appeal for the writer's room of Lost. That, like, you can tell, even though we're only about halfway through season 6, you can really tell that the Flash sideways was the thing that they wanted to do in season 6. And the other stuff is just them sort of like trying to like make the pieces fit. But I do agree with this. And I also think, like, if you were to ask like a much older post-Watchmen or Watchmen era Damon Lindelof, if he would have ended on the incident, I think maybe. Right? Like, that feels more in line, like, let the mystery be, like, that sort of thing that he's come to later in his career. But I do feel like that at the time, they seemed very in love with this idea of creating the Flash sideways, and then the way that the Flash sideways unfurls, and people start to wake up, and you get these connections. I think you would miss those really amazing emotional moments, you know? You'd miss the vending machine. And I think those moments are really great. So I would miss a lot of the Flash sideways stuff. Not so much the island stuff.
I'm going to piggyback real close to Neil there and say the series, like, what would the series say if it worked out that way and ended the incident? You know, like, there's never an end to the mystery, and don't worry, Jack could just blink it all out of existence.
I think, you know, as much as they could, online folks who are extremely online about Lost in 2010 and 2011 would have burned the place down if they would have ended on the incident. If it would have just been one last huge mystery, it would have been
well. No, I mean, I think what Ryan is saying is that the incident would be the penultimate, and then there would still be a 2-hour series finale after that. So when it wouldn't end with hitting the. It wouldn't end with the screen going to white.
Oh.
It would.
See, that was the way I heard it.
I was just wondering, like, the cleanness you get with separating 5 and 6 is 5 gets to be its own little time travel package, and 6 gets to reorient us to the characters while some bullshit we end up not liking about the mythology goes down. So effectively, the best mythology stuff ends at the incident. I completely agree with that. I'm just saying it's a big tonal shift from where we are at the incident at the end of a time travel season, where, like, basically understanding what they're trying to do with the incident is a huge fucking debate that takes them 3 episodes to, like, get over, you know.
But yeah. I mean, I'm not saying I want to watch season 6. I'm not saying I'm fully on board with Ryan's idea, but I want to clarify that he was, like, saying I agree, season 5 being the time travel season and season 6 being the Flash sideways season is cleaner, but what he's saying is, like, what if it's a 24 episode? We go back to the 24 episode format.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of space in the end there to put in stuff like the John Locke reveal and all this other stuff like that. Like, there's a room for a lot of that stuff without some of the, like, the temple bullshit. I mean, I think
he's breaking it like a TV series, but Lost is working episode to episode. So I'm saying, like, I get that, and I get the changes he made. I'm just wondering what you guys think the series would be about if we did that, because you're mixing in all the themes about, like, fate versus not fate, plus the character centric moments in a 24 episode season. It seems like a lot.
You know what would have been really difficult to pull off, which is something that Joanna keeps highlighting, which is that we turn back around on Jack.
Yeah.
Because think about where Jack was with the incident. I mean, if the incident is, like, the penultimate,
you're right.
Jack Shepard maybe goes down as one of the most disliked characters in television history, right?
I think you do need that sideways, that David stuff, to make Jack work in the end. Yeah, I think that's
I think they do. They use the sideways to recontextualize and sort of rehabilitate a number of things. And yeah, that's the stuff I think you would miss. Also, if you're making it a 24 episode season, that's what, only like 10 episodes shorter total than doing a whole than the way season 5 and 6.
I think he's just trying to save us from the temple, which I appreciate.
Sure.
Right? Thank
yeah,
you so
no,
much.
Cut the temple for sure.
I think there's a way to. I like the flash sideways. It was confusing in a way that I think did frustrate people, and I think that's all mm-hmm. true. I'm not disagreeing with that. I do think that the way in which it's a season one mirror, the way in which you can, as you guys have just said, could feel the eagerness and happiness of the writers to be back in their season one mode, which is let's do these little off-island New Yorker short stories that mirror what's happening on island and reveal something surprising about the characters. And it's surprising because, oh my gosh, Sawyer's a cop now. We thought he was a con mm-hmm. man, like all sort of stuff like that. So they're having fun back in their original premise, which so many shows have copied that original Lost premise. So many. So it's a winning premise. They just burn out of stories and they're like, well, what if we just write new stories? It's a new world, baby. And emotionally in the end, it's satisfying because of all that like waking up stuff that they do. But there are still, as we will continue to mention, issues with this final season. So I agree it needs a rework.
We still have to go across the sea.
I'm not sure I quite agree with Ryan's rework of it, but I think it's an interesting idea, and I would like to hear what anyone else has to say. If you guys want to email us, hoststormpodcast.com. As long as you keep Abaterno in there, we're good. We're solid. So let me know what you think. Abaterno plus vending machine. Make that work, and I can make anything work. And that's it for me. That's it for emails. But we got some good emails this week, and we got a really long email from another listener, Chris, that I just didn't have time to figure out how to condense down. I'll try to do that for next week, Chris. Thank you for that really long, lovely email, and I'll work on it. And also another really, really, really long email from Pat, but we just read one, so I'm gonna let that breathe, Pat. But we got time. But we love these storm emails so much. They really help shape what we talk about in this back section here. So send us more storm emails. We love them.
Yes. It's only around for a couple more episodes, this storm section.
Yeah.
Then we gotta go full storm. We'll call it full storm, let's say. Everybody gets to be part of the storm for the end. It'll be fun. But I'm also very excited for everybody, all of our call me's next week. Neil, where are we going?
Oh, I mean, it's an episode so iconic, it inspired a corner in the calm before anyone knows what the hell that means. It's Ab Eterno. It is the Ricardus origin story. We've been teased with the connection between Richard and the Black Rock. We will now see all of the things that happened to Richard. And it's, I mean, I just remember this being one of the wilder episodes of television I've ever seen, like watching a show live week to week. You know, they hit you with Ab Eterno right here in the middle of the season, and it's like, wait, what? And then they come along with Across the Sea, and this is where season 6 really kicks into its weirdest impulses, and this one definitely works, so I'm excited to revisit and talk about it.
TBD Across the Sea, but Ab Eterno.
Right.
Ab Eterno
one at a time
gives us the cork. So we're say goodbye to the cork. Cork is the storm horse. Here, it's like not the stone cork, but the island's described as a cork. So here we go. We're getting into the fun stuff.
We're into the cork era.
Into the cork era. Until next week, where can people find more of us around line? Let's start this week with Joanna Robinson.
Sorry, I just teared up thinking about the end of Ab Eterno. You can find me on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. As I mentioned, I did a little guest job over on the Ringerverse, talk about Loki. You can also hear me talking about Loki on the Still Watching podcast and talking about the Marlon Brando film On the Waterfront over on Little Gold Men.
And Mr. Neil Miller.
Well, you know, you can always get me over at filmschoolrejects.com or on Twitter at rejects or at One Perfect Shot. That's a fun one. That's a fun thing that I spend a lot of time on. And don't forget to follow the show at Storm Podcast on Twitter, where we will have yet another fun, I'm sure, history poll.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can also find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast. And coming up here, Neil and I are going to be on the Screen Drafts podcast. It's our turn to be on the Screen Drafts podcast. We're doing legacy sequels. It is going to be a chaos fun time.
No controversial answers there.
Yeah, no. Everyone agrees what the best legacy sequels are and on the definition. Surely there won't be any discussion to be had. Check that out. And Fighting in the War Room, wherever fantastic podcasts can be found. And until all of those things transpire, I will be here telling you at the end of each episode of Lost, do not fall down.